Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, April 23rd, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 152. It is almost May. I think it's spring. I think we made it to spring.
Is it really, though? Or is it a tease? Is it going to snow tomorrow?
I went outside and my entire face was filled with pollen, so I think we made it. I think that's okay. You might be right. That's the voice of Danielle Riendo, obviously, joining me from sunny Brooklyn.
Sunny Brooklyn, but just over the line from Queens.
Sunny Brooklyn is my Sopranos OC.
Also joining me,
Patrick Klepek.
Yeah, hey, in Illinois is warm too. It's 62 degrees out.
Look at you.
Turned down my AC. Or my heat, rather, and yeah, it's good.
You're just living inside and playing video games.
Now I'm just my whole everything about me is crumbling in that single sentence. Oh no!
This is our lives, you know. That's what we do. You said you were wearing something special. What were you wearing?
I'm wearing short sleeves. It's not going to feel good as soon as the sun goes down, but. Okay, at that point I'll be inside, so fuck it.
Do you ever get the feeling that like you encourage the weather to change by being just like obstinate about your fashion choices? Where you're like, no, I'm dressing for summer. It's gonna be summer.
Well, that's more I'm stubborn about it, and the cold doesn't bother me that much, so I can push it like where my wife is dressing up in clearly much more appropriate temperature based weather. But I'm like, nah, like I'm done. I'm in this, and because the cold doesn't bother me that much, like I at some point will just be stubborn about it. And even though it's like 4:30 and the sun's going down and the wind is picked up, and if someone asks, "Are you cold?" I'll be like, "I'm fine. I'm cold."
You're cold. Yeah, 100%, 100%. How were your weekends? Did you both have nice spring weekends?
I was on my ambulance driving last night. I drove to my first call. That was exciting.
Wait, so you just started actually driving?
Yeah, like you're actually behind the wheel. With the patient, I'm in the front making all kinds of calls. And I was doing that last night as well.
Wait, what sort of calls are you making? Are you like what type of calls are you making?
Like what you do with this patient. Like,
Is the person driving like in charge of the crew?
No, the crew chief is in charge of the crew. There's a crew chief, a driver, and an attendant on each. That's how we do it anyway. And occasionally we don't have an attendant, but usually it's like three people. Attendant is typically like the person who does like a lot of the patient care, who is like, all right, I'm going to splint that. All right, I'm going to take your vital signs. The crew chief is in charge of the crew and also makes like the calls, like, should we do this or this for this person?
They're like the team captain. They're like the team captain. And then
the driver is in charge of the equipment, like the ambulance itself and the equipment, that kind of thing. So I'm training to be a driver. I am a crew chief normally or an attendant normally, but now I'm training to be a driver. I drove to my first call and I was definitely going like 30 miles an hour because that thing is scary, but with lights and sirens, so watch out, friends.
Yeah, I bet that's a whole trip. Patrick, did you save anybody's life this weekend?
I mean, you know, mental health is important, and so you got to get out in your relationships and go see A Quiet Place for your mental health because you haven't seen a horror film in a movie theater in a while. And so,
nice. How'd that go?
Oh, it's excellent. I thought it was worth the hype.
It lives up to the hype. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know a lot of people, kind of generally write off horror movies, not because they don't think they could be like good entertainment movies, but they don't like being scared. Like that's not part of like their entertainment repertoire.
Sure.
And I don't 100% get that. And I respect that. But I would classify A Quiet Place as more as a thriller. It's not gory. It's not violent. I mean, there are allusions to violence. There is occasional blood, but it is not something that like revels in that in the way that a lot of others, and it's not a jump scare movie either. That is not to say there aren't moments that like kind of pop at you, but it is really more of a thriller in which the tension is derived from like very obvious things. Like you know what's going to happen, and then it happens, and then it's just really tense when it happens. And the movie shows just an incredible commitment to its bit of like the characters don't really talk. They one of the daughters of Josh Krasinski's character in the film is deaf, and they actually cast like someone who's deaf, which that's was cool. Like not something you can like advertise in the movie, but like right. I read about it, and like that's cool that like they were, you know, committed enough to make sure that like they found someone that was like very appropriate for that role. So yeah, it's really good. And but if you like thrillers and you're worried that movie is a horror movie, like it is not. Like I think it actually it's part of the reason I think it's been as popular as it has is because it fits a much broader sort of demographic. But yeah, I liked it a lot.
Awesome. I still want to see that. You know, I saw a trailer for it probably ahead of Annihilation or something else. I was like, I should go see that.
And then... good theater movie. Like I watch most movies at home. The only time that we're lucky that my mom, who watches my kid twice a week, lives near a movie theater. And so like we actually get to see like a decent number of films in a theater because we just have a convenient setup for like dropping her off. She goes to bed. We can go see a movie quick and like be back on the road at 9 o'clock and go home. But we generally only go see like Marvel movies and stuff like that. That feels like a real justified use of like a big ass screen. And asking
right.
my mom
like
for
the spectacle is yeah, meaningful.
The spectacle is really meaningful. I mean, like I also think because I have a projector at home, so it's like I can get some of that spectacle in my own home. But A Quiet Place, like because the sound, like the one thing that my house doesn't have is like a particularly good speaker setup. Like that's like a project I'd like to get to at some point, but I want to spend the kind of money if I'm going to do it. Like I want to do it, and I can't justify that at the moment. But this is a movie where like the sound design is unbelievably good. So less for the picture, more for the sound. It's worth seeing on the big screen, and also because audiences are fun with.
I was gonna ask about that, like if the audience experience is a big part of that for you, especially for this movie.
Yes and no. I think A Quiet Place is PG-13, which is usually not the movie I want to see in a theater because I was an asshole teenager, and these days, like especially with phones and everything, like it's just there are a lot more ways for kids to be distracted, and that's less to dunk on teenagers as much as like I get like one moment to like have a fresh just like horror as a genre. Like there's a lot to like the first experience of a thing. Yeah. Just by the nature of the medium or the genre. And so it's like my wife and I have gone to enough. The theater we go to specifically caters to like near a high school. And so there's just a lot of high school students there. And so if it's a PG-13 horror film, we tend to not go to them or wait a couple of weeks when we can get the theater more to ourselves. But this one we had a really good crowd, and the gasps and the way that it's a movie about sound and people not talking, and the audience like totally plays along with that because you also don't want to make any sound. It's good. So anyway,
awesome.
There's my end of the podcast recommendation. Acquired.
I guess that's
your
waypoint is already set.
I have another one, but this
all right,
year
good.
I'll just,
put that one in your back pocket.
Yeah. There you go.
So no, you didn't save lives, is what you're telling me.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Sorry. If the barometer of like how I spend my weekends is relative to the good that Danielle Riendo puts into the world, then boy. I'm fucking up on a daily basis.
Yeah, fair, same.
Sorry, I play a lot of Into the Breach, too, so don't feel bad.
All right, well, there we go. I mean, speaking of Max...
Well, that's why it's so difficult to drive at 30 miles an hour with sirens, because you're doing Into the Breach turns with a random squad.
Because, like, so where should I put this ice mech? I don't know.
crashing in the back over here.
I played my own mech game. I played a little bit more Battletech. I'll talk a little bit about that. That'll be my waypoint at the end of the show. We're getting all those out of the way up top. I'll save that for then, and then Rob and I will probably dig deeper into it at some future, probably for like a waypoint article read, because I want to go deep in it with Rob, because he has put in probably as much time as I have, if not more. And that was fun. And then I also played a little bit of a game called The Swords of Ditto, which is Devolver's latest published game. It's by a studio called One Bit Beyond. I saw it originally last E3, and it comes out this week. I want to say it comes out on the 24th, tomorrow. It is a kind of very cartoonish roguelike, but like roguelike is... It's an action adventure game like an action RPG in the vibe of something like Link to the Past.
Yeah, like
it's like
very
much
very like it's the art of
Adventure Time or something, or Steven Universe, a little Steven Universe for sure.
But it cannot understate like how good like the animation and
it's fantastic.
It's I mean the
bright
the,
and the colorful.
The cliche of it looks like a you're playing a cartoon is like pretty dead because like that's been used like trotted out all the time. But I've played a lot of those games and seen a lot of those games, and even my like first couple minutes with Swords of Ditto was like a very like oh shit like this is just like.
It genuinely looks like that.
It genuinely does. It is a really striking game.
And I think the premise is really strong. So, you know, when I got this demo at E3, it was at the Devolver. I mean, it wasn't at E3. It was at the Devolver parking lot across from E3. Devolver and the ESA. No, not the ESA. Is the ESA who does E3? What's the company behind E3? Yeah, okay. My brain is not so addled. I'm technically on a sick day. I apologize in advance.
On your sick day.
Yeah, well. The picture that I got at the Devolver kind of parking lot for this game was that it's a sort of generational take on Link to the Past with some roguelike elements. You arrive to this island that has like a town called Ditto in the middle of the island. And all around the island, there are enemies or monsters that have been, you know, the island is being overrun by monsters under the control or influence of an evil, like,
witch.
Warlock or witch. Yeah, witch named Mormo. And you go into these temples that have special items in them, very similar to, like, the boomerang or bombs or the hookshot or whatever from Zelda. And those will help you, you know, solve puzzles. And then you eventually go and you fight Mormo. And if you win, the world changes. If you lose, you jump ahead a generation, you become the next Sword of Ditto, and the world has gotten darker because Mormo has been able to advance her plans. But if you win, things become a little bit brighter, and you kind of push back the darkness, and the entire world becomes a little more colorful and a little bit more at peace. But I believe that the pitch was also like, it also gets harder because you're winning more and more, and Mormo is kind of needing to push back a little bit harder. The entire pitch is around this notion of like, oh, you're making changes across multiple playthroughs, kind of suggesting the sort of arc or structure of something like Rogue Legacy or Shiren the Wanderer or like other sorts of roguelikes that are not just one and done, but that they have some sort of like more than Spelunky even, or more than Binding of Isaac, where you're unlocking items that might show up or information that might show up or whatever, but actually changing the game world.
Well, it's a little bit of what you talked about of wanting from Breath of the Wild was that at the end it would have been nice to see some of the consequences of your actions, and the whole premise of like a new game in the Legend of Zelda series is often, you know, if you buy into the timeline theory, but even what they generally propose, is that like the start of every new adventure is a new generation, right? Like X number of years, you know, presumably, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of years have passed, and, you know, hope is now needed once again, blah, 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 blah. And this game says rather than
now, everything changes. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, like rather than that being something that takes place in the next game, it's like, well, what if that's built in to each death? And I knew precious little about this game other than, oh, it looks like Zelda. Oh, it's got cool art. And so when I died the first time, I played like maybe like an hour, and then I got to what they call the toy dungeons. Like, it is kind of funny. They just say like, yo, like the there's like a toy aesthetic that's going on in the game. Like, stickers are these sort of like bonuses that you can equip on your character. So you get like 5% like armor bonus or 20% against poison, blah, blah, blah. Then to find, these like special items, you go into these toy dungeons, and I fought the boss at the end of that dungeon, died. And then, like, yeah, it's just, it spawns you in 100 years later or whatever, and then you go and pick up your sword and you start
over fresh.
Fresh-ish, because you're, the one thing that does carry over, at least in so far that I've discovered, is that your level. So it's like if you have leveled up to level 4, when you pick up the sword on the next quest, like, you will start at level 4, so you're not starting from scratch in terms of, like, health and attack power.
Right.
But the game does scale with you a little bit. So it's not like you could just sit in the first area and like grind for 100 hours and then just like roll through the game.
There is like a time limit too, because like the whole setup is like in 4 days Mormo will arrive.
Oh, you mean Majora's Mask?
Yeah, I was just gonna ask.
Yes, exactly, Danielle. Yeah. And okay, like, you have to be ready for that fight by then, which means you need to have done the toy dungeons to get the toys are the like, items, right? So, like, you know, there's a vinyl record that you can get that you can throw that bounces off of walls, and so maybe you need to, like, throw it through a portal so that it bounces from this side of the room to hit a switch on the other side or whatever, right? You know, there's all sorts of, like, little things like that, and those are all really neat. I will say that general structure, the thing of, like, oh, you level up and you keep leveling up from game to game, might be something that at first blush runs against what I wanted from this game, though, where so here's the very beginning of this game, and my hope is that this I lose this feeling as I keep playing and I level up more and more, but, like, I got to the first dungeon and it's like, oh, well, you're level one, you need to be level two to open up this dungeon. It's like, okay, well, how far do I have to go to for level two? And it was a lot. It was like I had to grind for 10 minutes to get from level 1 to level 2. Or you can go help people. But I didn't find anybody with, like, side quests to go help. And so it was this weird thing of, like, okay, I'm grinding for 10 minutes. And, like, all right, I'm done with that. And I'm going to launch the game again. Or I die in that dungeon and I get to start over. And now, yeah, I'm, like, level 1. I'm level 2.1 or whatever. 2 plus a little bit of XP that I have left. So, yeah, I can go back to that first dungeon. But, like, it didn't give me the feeling of starting fresh. Like, what I had expected was sort of like, I'm going to go through this run, and when I die, I die, and then the next time I'll be able to level up a whole new character and start over, you know what I mean? And instead it's just this kind of, like, constant ongoing progress, which doesn't really work for the generational thing for me right now. Again, 5 hours from now, you know, I'm like 80, 90, you know, minutes in or something. It doesn't feel like it's hitting the promise, and it's a little slower than I thought it would be.
Well, yeah, and I'll say, like, the game doesn't really explain a lot
any of the pitch that we just made.
Right, okay. Like, so the game, like, it doesn't... I think greatly to a fault, does yes. not tutorialize enough of, like, what is actually happening mechanically in the game. Like, it's one thing to be obtuse because, like, hey, like, we want players to, like, discover on their own. And then there's what this right. game does, which is just to, like, it has a tutorial character who, like, makes jokes about being a tutorial character. And then, so what happens is, like, I heard it was kind of roguelike-y and there was maybe some randomization to parts of the world, but, like, it just wasn't clear to me what any of that was. And I was like, okay, well, I guess I'll discover that stuff as I go along, or it'll explain some of it. And then I die at the first boss. Like, the boss just kicks my ass. Like, I just did not have a prayer. And it's not like you get sent back to the start of the dungeon and then, like, well, maybe give it another go. Like, maybe you should learn, like, the pattern or what's going on with this. Does that mean, like, I walked in, got my ass kicked, died, and then it just, like, boots you back to the start. And there's no, the little tutorial character doesn't come up to you and go, hey, here's what happened. Like,
right.
Like, even if it's, like, meta moment, like, brrr, like, hey, player, like,
right.
Or even a jokey, find some way to, like, speak to the
right,
player.
Well, so, like,
and instead what happens is, like, you just get spawned back into the world again. It says, hey, go pick up your sword, and then just do it again.
Do it again.
And
right.
So,
and it doesn't talk about any of the ways the world has changed. It doesn't deliver on the stuff that
doesn't
was
tell you you've lost
to
your
me.
Those side quests that I found. I found two of them in my first run. Those are just gone. Like, which makes sense because it's 100 years later. But
right,
like,
sure,
it was frustrating because what does change is the geography of the overworld that you're
right.
dealing with, and so. In my first run, whether through luck or because this the game is structured, the first toy dungeon was not very far. Like, it was a few
right.
screens over, and I could just make my way there. Oh, that was definitely not the fucking case with the second one, where it was, like, a full 30 minutes of, like, going through a ton of screens.
Right.
And I get there, and it's not like you walk in, and it's like, oh, the last hero was here, and he's already solved the puzzles for you. So just, like... make your way
no.
to the boss. It's like, no, you have to solve a whole other dungeon
did
again.
Did you get the same dungeon the second time?
No, it's a completely different dungeon.
Yeah.
So it's
so
not even like
thing.
I can use the previous knowledge to just, like,
right.
knock it out. Instead, it's like, so I've got to go through a whole other dungeon, and I have no knowledge from that previous boss fight. Or even, is it the same boss? Is this going to be like Binding of Isaac, where the bosses are random? I don't know. Like, and it set up a hill that I was all of a sudden was like, if this was just a normal Zelda game, or, like, normal by, like, what I, like, consider, like, a, you know, a general Zelda structure, I might have wanted to keep playing this. But when all of a sudden I was like, am I really going to spend 30 minutes going through a puzzle to walk into a boss room, get my ass kicked, and then do it over again? Because they scale the level requirement to get into
right.
the dungeon. So there's, like, this little circle out in front, and it is literally just a level signifier. And I,
it's like
it was
two or three.
Yeah, it required
whatever.
Two the first time around, and then when I spawned back into the world, obviously leveled up a little more. It was three, and so it was like the strategy then. Like I need to go spend an hour grinding and hope that that number doesn't go up in that instant. I mean, like it just that stuff really. Or so, is this the game telling me, hey, you need to go do a bunch of other stuff and then, like, come back and maybe I'll get a superpower that, like, I don't know, lets me run a boss. Because they imply in the game, like, hey, you can, like, you'll be able to play with time and, like, do some other stuff. I'm like, oh, maybe that means I'm, like, going to this toy dungeon. That stuff really frustrated me. And
right.
I almost felt myself immediately bouncing off the game in a way that I didn't want to. But
yeah,
the game
it's
wasn't
clear
doing...
there's so much here that is like it's really cool looking, and I love the idea of a sort of like proc gen Legend of Zelda Link to the Past style thing. And generational storytelling is always a really fucking cool thing that we don't get enough of in video games, so I want to support it. But like, it does such a bad job of showing you what the cool shit is, if it's there at all in play. Do you know what I mean? The other thing briefly before we, you know, I don't want to just dunk on this game for an hour, you know?
Just because we're both about 90 minutes in, like,
yes.
I mean, I'll say, like, rough the bat, like, it's a pretty poor, like, first 90 minutes. And if we're both bouncing off it and it sounds like relatively similar ways, like, that's not great. That said, like, there's enough here that, like, I want to put in, like, 4 or 5 hours, and if that's where I still fall, then so be it, and maybe the game's not for me.
Right. I'm really curious about what the, like, overall, how the structure, so again, the overworld is proc gen, right? It is like, or something, right? It changes. Maybe there's a set of overworld maps that it shuffles. I don't know. But it seems like there are different rooms, so to speak, in the overworld. And then you find different temples in different orders. You find different toy temples, toy dungeons each time. So the first time through, I got a toy that was like really boring. I got this like drone that could explode.
That doesn't carry over?
I don't think I had that the second time. I died. I didn't finish that. I didn't finish that. I died. So okay. I didn't finish that dungeon.
All
I don't
right.
think I came back with that toy with me. But my point is, like, you know, the structure of a Zelda game, obviously, like, Danielle, you can speak to this. You watch a lot of speedrunners. People can
sure
sequence break, right? yeah. And, like, go like, oh, I'm not going to go get the hookshot at this point. I'm going to go get the boomerang or whatever.
Yeah.
But in for most players, when they go through a contemporary, you know, a Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time forward Zelda game, or even a Link to the Past forward Zelda game, they will go through it in a pretty much prescribed order in which you the designers know which tools you get when.
Yeah.
And this game obviously isn't going to run into any problems where you have to have a certain tool to progress that you don't have yet because it knows what tools you have. But what it doesn't do is, like, I didn't get a cool one first. I got a really boring one. I flew this shitty drone around, and then, like, it could bump into things and do minimal damage, or I could hold down the button to do, like, meaningful damage, and it would, like, eventually blow up. But it was just corny. Like, it was just, like, I've seen cool toys. You know, there's, like, a laser ring. There's, like, the vinyl records that you kind of throw and bounce around. And there's all sorts of other neat toys that you can play with in the game, both literal and figurative. But it didn't give me. I got the bad one out the gate, and it's one of those things like, oh man, I hope that the kind of random nature of what players see in order doesn't just turn a lot of players off the way it almost did for me. So we'll see. I'm gonna put some more time into it. Danielle, I think you should check it out. I really feel like it's something both in style and structure, you know, style and just gameplay is very much a Danielle Riendo joint.
Yeah.
And I really want to know what your perspective is on it for sure.
I'm super, super interested in this. Even hearing about the flaws, I am
right.
definitely interested in, you know, I've had a weird streak with Devolver lately, but a lot of it actually has not been bad. A lot of it actually has been good. I loved Minute, obviously.
Right.
I think we all did. So
yeah, yeah.
I'm super,
it's super,
super
funny to see this after Minute is what I'll say.
Yeah, totally. Like, I was going to ask, like, this seems like anti-Minute in a lot of ways, in weird
right,
ways, maybe.
Right, like, that can be a totally okay thing, right? Like,
yeah.
Minute was really interested in brevity and in, like, you know, what you can do with a repeated pattern. Whereas this is very much about scale and about, like, randomization and not about just, like, memorizing a single thing. So
100 years instead of 60 seconds, you know?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. There's, yeah, there it is. There's your deck.
Cool. Oh, yeah. There we go.
Well, and, like, just before we recorded this, there was one of the writers on the game did this big, like, tweet storm about the sort of like story that they're trying to tell in the game that like got me like super interested, like brought me off the ledge I was on. I was like, okay, I'm gonna put some more time in a way that the game didn't necessarily do. But they were, you know, talking about the fact that in the game you will eventually start coming across these like tablets that like start laying out the history of like the Swords of Dodo. Like they've really, it sounds like, thought through like a really long mythology for this world that you get some like small indications of when you first start poking around the game. But it sounds like so for example, you're gonna find like it's something like 64 tablets, and they originally sort of like blocked off when you could get certain tablets because it might like spoil huge parts of like the larger mythology, and instead they decided to kind of play into the roguelike like right. nature in the story and saying like, well, some players might get that really rare drop that like gives you like a big impression of like what's going on here, and then that's just, we're just going to see how players respond. And on top of that, they revealed some of the like larger meta structure of the game, which is that beating the game is not just beating the Wizard Mormo. Like all that does is just make the world better, and you're like pushing against like a cycle, and that they're like the quote-unquote true ending is related to like what do you do about cycles and like that all, I was like, oh shit, they're like, that sounds like the idea that like some like a big Zelda fan would think about cycles, and that would make a game whose storytelling is like explicitly about cycles and breaking cycles of like oppression and stuff. I was like, that, okay, like, all right, like, okay, you're pulling me back in. And so, and I also wonder if like the things we call flaws, maybe they're strengths once you like get over a certain, you know, hill with the game. And I don't feel like I've gotten there yet. And I'm hopeful that I am, because like the game's so pretty and the mechanics are actually like feel really good. I want to spend more time with it. I'll have to see if it'll, we'll have to see if it'll let me.
I think it also has local co-op, so maybe we should look into that. Maybe Danielle,
okay. Oh,
see
yeah.
how that is. I wish it had online multiplayer, because that would be, that's traditionally how I play multiplayer games. But you know what? We have an office and a studio, and can look into that at least, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe we should spend some time with it and see if we can wrap around and do a stream or something. All right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk more about some video games.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
All right, we are back. On Friday, we spent some time playing a bunch of stuff. We did kind of it was one of those weeks where like it snuck up on us, and then we were like, oh shit, there's a billion things to stream all at once. Luckily, we
all
were able
on 420.
Just kind of landed on our lap like that. And so we did a big stream. We did some Battletech. We played some Spy Party, which was the first time I'd ever played Spy Party. Is that in early access now on Steam?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Spy Party is cool as hell. It is like a kind of social manipulation, like competitive game. In
do,
which
do you
one...
want to set it up? Like how one
yeah.
plays?
I guess, right? So like, what's the high level? The high level is like one of you is a sniper and the other one is a spy at a party. A spy party. And the spy has a bunch of goals, right? And those goals are things like, hey, switch this statue with a fake. Or plant a bug on one of the members of the party, or I'm trying to think of something else that's like super obvious. What was something that's really obvious? Flirt, but the sniper can't really see the flirting is the thing.
Okay,
it was bugging, like, trying bugging to people? bug the
yeah.
ambassador.
Yeah, bugging the ambassador is probably the easiest one, right? The most
you
obvious
end up, you
one.
End up seeing, like, you know, basically the person who's the spy is trying to look like an NPC, and so you're trying to do like robotic. Sort of like, you know, go from one side to the other, and then what is the tells are, you're trying to obscure those tells. And so like when you're trying to bug the ambassador, like your hand does a pretty unique motion next to a character. And so as the spy or as the sniper, you're trying to pick up on that.
Right, exactly. And there's all sorts of other little tells, right? So like there's a clock that's counting down for the spy where they have to complete a number of like missions that they have assigned to them. And As the clock ticks down, one of the things the spy can do is, like, add more time to their mission by going and doing something very obvious, like checking their watch or their phone at a window. And then, like, the timer will go up, and if the sniper realizes that it just went up and they can see the you know, one of the NPCs, one of the characters at the party, checking their watch at the window, they can be pretty sure it is the spy. You know what my favorite one is? My favorite one is that there are two characters that are marked for the sniper as being potential double agents. And the spy has to, like, deliver information to them or make contact with the double agent. And when they do, there is just a voiceover that goes, "Banana bread." And at that moment, the sniper has to stop whatever else they're doing and be like, "Oh shit, who is talking to one of the suspected double agents right now?" Because then I'll know those are the only people that it could be. Anybody who's not talking to a double agent, I can mark those and kind of like turn them into silhouettes. You can low light them so that you know it can't be them because they weren't talking to the double agent at the time. It's a really clever game. One player plays the spy, one player plays the sniper. It's been in circles for years, but this was the first time I sat down to actually play it. I know Danielle, it was the first time you saw it too.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's one of those things, I've been following it for years, but never actually had my hands on it. And I guess I haven't still, but you know, I was there. Feel like I was participating in the anxiety that was playing Spy Party, which is
I consistently
fun.
Thought that you and Danica saw shit I didn't see, like, constantly.
There were a couple of times we did, but it was only because, like, when you're in a group, you have the sort of luxury of, like, I could focus on two things, and she could focus on two things, and you had to look at 10 things, so it was, you know. I just kept watching for the watch animation the timer changing.
If you're focused on that, you'll find it, right?
Yeah.
The one that I loved the most was the statue switching. Yes. So there's one of the goals that the spy can have is, like, they have to take one of the statues and switch it out with another statue. And the way that looks is, like, they pick up a statue and then it just, like, magically transforms into a different one, and they put it back down. And you'll know it happens, one, if you see it happening, obviously. But also, you can just memorize as the sniper what the statues are and what order they're in. So it's like the Venus of Willendorf, I think it's like a bust of Shakespeare or something, and then the Maltese Falcon, basically. Yeah. And it's like, okay, you know, Falcon, Venus, like, bust. And, like, you memorize that. And then the thing that caught me off guard, Patrick, you beat me, like, right away on the first or second time, was you changed it. And in my head, I'd gotten so confused and I couldn't remember the order of the statues. I couldn't be sure if they'd actually changed or not. It's a really good game for self-doubt.
Yeah, which is why I don't think I'm ever going to play it again, because I didn't really have fun playing it. I didn't. Like, I found that it made me, like, incredibly anxious. It was one thing to, like, do it in front of a stream, too. Right. Maybe that was, like, not, like, it was not, I'm not a typically anxious person, but, like, I didn't particularly enjoy playing that game. Right. Like, I think it's really well made. Like, I think it's super cool. And maybe I would feel better if I had, like, a better, like, a handle, because we're, like, learning a lot of the mechanics. Like, I basically got fucked on one of the rounds because I didn't realize I had to put a book away.
Right. That part of it sucked. That part of it definitely. There was definitely, like, one of those things of, like, oh, there are a lot of micro rules here that are not gotten into in any way. And so it's hard to even know, like, whether or not I'm fucking up or whether I'm, like, I won for the same reason, which is I put a book away and didn't realize that was the way that you moved the microfiche or whatever it was, you know? So it's neat. It's worth checking out at least. You can watch that stream. That stream is up on youtube.com/waypointvice. Or it will be.
I think it's
either up today or tomorrow. Okay. So try to take a look at that. We had a good time, but, like, very stressful. Like, one of the most stressful on-stream games I think I've ever played. So,
yeah, I was sweating for you, and that really says something.
I appreciate it. I was sweating during the Nintendo Labo portion stream.
Different reason, though.
Yeah, different reason. Mostly you and Danica putting on your like, fucking Rhode Island auntie voices and just torturing me as I tried to fish with a cardboard fishing rod.
That was a lot of fun.
Do you want to talk a little bit about Nintendo Labo, since you probably have the most experience with it at this point?
For sure, and I've actually made the same two things twice, which is kind of funny. those are the exact – the RC car, which is, like, the simplest of all Nintendo Labo. And if you don't know what Nintendo Labo is, the high-level thing is you make cardboard sort of figures, and then you get to play mini games with them using your Switch, basically.
Right.
So the RC car is very, very simple. It's just a little tiny cardboard car, and you kind of put two – little Joy-Cons in it, and you can drive it by sort of manipulating the Joy-Cons, which is pretty cool, actually. A lot of fun. But the more involved project that we did, of course, was the fishing rod, which is more, you know, they give you sort of a time estimate on how long it'll take. I think the fishing rod is like 90 minutes to 2 hours. It's really like an hour. Like, if especially if you have two people making the thing or three people making the thing. Because
like two people making it and one person like advancing the instructions on the screen.
Exactly. Because that's the actual slowest part. That's the actual pain point with Labo is how slowly the instructions go, which I understand this is made for children. It's just, you know, look, if you're a Lego master or are a Lego master, you're not going to need, you're not going to need 3 hours to put the fishing rod together. But I'm just saying. Building it is a lot of fun. I actually really, really enjoy it and find it incredibly satisfying from that, again, like Lego kid point of view. It feels great to put together little cardboard things, and there's a lot of little articulation points that are very, very satisfying to play with. The fishing rod, for example, has like a click with each rotation of the rod itself. It actually has a little click. Oh, it's so good. Really, really fun to kind of put together. It's fun to do tactile things. It's fun to put things together in general. And then, of course, there's the mini game, the fishing mini game. I've played it. I think it's fine. But I do think the inherent fun of Labo, at least at this level, maybe there's going to be like a meta with Labo later on, which I wouldn't be surprised, honestly, because you can actually create other things using sort of like a very basic programming interface.
Wait, have you messed with that stuff at all?
No, I've only seen it, but I plan on messing with it. Let's put it that way. There will be a mess made with Labo.
Okay.
It'll be great.
Jeez.
but yeah, I think the fun of it right now is building things. I think like the mini games are totally cool and fun. I know, Austin, you played the fishing mini game, and you sure did get a foot-related fish, which was
good. I got a football fish, and I'm still mad about it. I actually really love how it feels. Like, there was I didn't expect the tension on the line to feel directional the way it did.
Sure.
Or honestly, for there to feel like there was tension at all. But there was. And so that was cool. I'm curious how the rest of those things are. I suspect that my shoulders are too broad for the robot, unfortunately. Aww. That's my guess. But, you know, that's how it goes. But I'd still like to see what the rest of those mini games are all about, basically. I'm always going to support Nintendo doing weird experiments like this.
Yeah.
And especially stuff that does have that kind of more open-ended or not open source at all, but like stuff that encourages players to figure out and play with and program and make their own shit, because that ends up being a lot of my favorite stuff that comes out of Nintendo things, like whether that's Mario Maker, there was something else I just had in mind and I've already lost. Even just like the way the Wii worked, you know, encouraged lots of people to use the Wii motion controller as a input device in new ways. And stuff like that is just like Nintendo is uniquely poised to take those chances in the market. And it's important that they do, because other people aren't incentivized to, you know, like, we've seen what happens when Microsoft launches Kinect or when Sony tries to do Move controllers. Those projects, one, they just like don't have the right vibe. Nintendo Labo is so joyful and so, just energetic in a way that those other products just never are. It feels genuine, and partly because it's like big, brightly colored cardboard, and partly because it has like great Nintendo menu music all throughout. And the tutorials, super funky, overlong tutorials, but also very Nintendo-y, but also very like in that mode of like, oh yeah, we're hanging out, we're playing with toys. I sometimes think that Nintendo understands that toys are fun and that not everything good has to be a game-ass game, do you know? And that comes from a position of security in the medium, not a position of like, feeling that like there is something that needs to be protected or upheld, or that like we need prestige. Like, toys are valuable things, and it's cool to make those, and it's cool to have like the experience of building Nintendo Labo be a fun and enjoyable experience. I'm curious. I'm curious how the rest of those things are. I'd love to make some time to maybe build one or two of those things. Awesome. Anybody playing anything else, or can we go into the question bucket?
We can take a dip.
Let's take a dip.
I just want to say, just as an aside. Please. Fuckwanic Dream?
Yeah, you know what? We should have that. Do you want to talk about that real quick, Patrick? That's no need to make it an aside.
Yeah, so there was a series of reports that we at least touched on and discussed a number of months back, which I think a trio of French publications collaborated, or at least two of the publications collaborated. I'm mixed on the exact specifics there, about the workplace at Quantic Dream, the developers of Heavy Rain, and the upcoming Detroit Become Human, which comes out in just a couple of weeks. And I guess there's a demo up on PSN, like right now or tomorrow.
Yeah, something.
And insinuated there were, other than your traditional, cynically, traditional long hours and things like that, like a history of misogyny and racism and jokes and asides that really went over the line and made it an uncomfortable place to work. And apparently that really got Quantic Dream and David Cage specifically to publicly push back on those reports. There's this really fascinating story of a Kotaku, which is where this originally broke, because it's not like this went out in a press release, in which Jason Schreier, who was off doing some press for the French version of his book, Blood, Sweat and Pixels?
Blood, Sweat and Pixels, yeah.
And Pixels. I didn't know if there was an and. I just looked it on my shelf.
You just looked over
I just looked over the mail. And he was supposed to do some sort of a Q&A with this French journalist, and they couldn't show up because they were in court. And it turns out they were in court because they were being about to be sued by Quantic Dream. And then Kotaku went coincidentally to a press event for Detroit Become Human in New York. And before Sony PR could probably understandably on their side shut it down, confirmed with David Cage that he was suing those journalists. So that is currently, I believe, two of the publications are being sued, and one of the publications has so far not seen legal paperwork. So basically, Jason Cattell, he noted this earlier, and as far as I can recall, this is really the first instance in which a major video game developer / publisher is suing based on the reporting of a series of journalists. Jim Sterling, a games critic who used to be at Destructoid, now on YouTube, he was famously sued by this really crummy garbage company, had to deal with that, had to get a lawyer and dispute that and shoot that thing down. But that was a case of him sort of dragging those games from a critic's perspective and that person trying to abuse the legal system.
Reporting that is being held up
and
being accused
bad.
Of being defamation.
No world am I going to argue what that studio did to Jim Sterling is at all acceptable. It was also bad on the merits. But this is also an extraordinary act that, it's fucked. It's bad. It's a very and also strategically. Let me just point out, probably not great. At the same time, they have all these previews going up, which cursor I look, were rather positive about the game. And then at the same time, you are suing a journalist. Only weeks away, days away from probably review copies of that game landing in people's laps. Just a bad PR strategy is to try and shit on the very people that you're hoping are going to go out there and praise your game. Cage is a guy that reads the reviews.
Right. Not just are doing the thing, but Cage himself at the event says, quote, "We're suing their journalists." The Sony PR handler couldn't shut him down quick enough for him not to say out loud, "We're suing their journalists," which is it's top level mismanagement of how to do that. It's so bad. And also just fuck off. There is a degree. There should be recourse for if
slander and defamation.
Slander and defamation laws should be in existence for good reason. There are absolutely, tabloids that will prey upon, misdirecting and deceiving their readership and creating complete bullshit and accusing people of things and leaning on unsubstantiated rumors and there should be lines in the sand to make sure that even that readers are protected from such shitty so-called journalists, right?
Right.
Absolutely. But there's a huge distinction between that and then these stories about Quantic Dream, which were undertaken as a partnership between three different media outlets, ranging from, you know, an online sites like Mediapart and Canard PC to like Le Monde, which is one of the most, you know, well-regarded papers in the world.
They're not random blogs, right? Like, it's right. Not even that a random blog couldn't break a story that news, like right, this, totally. But, like, there's reason based on David Cage's history, the way he talks, right. The way he has spoken about various subjects, to look at this with some measure of suspicion.
The content of his games, even. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's funny because he says, like, look at my content to see how my heart is. You know, like, I make games with Jesse Williams. I make games with, what is her name?
Elliot Page. No, that's wrong.
Wrong. This is gonna kill me. I can't believe this is.
We're not allowed to Google it.
Ellen Page.
Yeah, yes.
Ellen Page.
Why didn't I know that? Oh,
yes. Ellie is the name of the character from The Last of Us.
Ellie. Oh, Ellie Page.
That's, so you just combined them. That's. All.
I was just thinking Ellie.
Right, gotcha.
I'm sorry. Fair. In my head.
And so, like, you know, but if you actually look at the content of his games, there are hints there that maybe that dude's, like, interests and politics are not on the up and up. There is a degree to which even just the general response to that first story breaking, those set of stories breaking, was so antagonistic and so much more concerned with public perception than about making sure that your own culture at your company is secure. Like, listen, we are advice. We've been dealing with scandals and shitty announcements for the last 7 months. You know, we've spoken pretty openly about the fact that we have, that when we came here, we knew that Vice has a weird history, but we hope that we can be part of a group that kind of pushes it in the right direction. And we know that change is slow. We did not know at all, like, how frustrating those scandals and bad those scandals would be and how people would be hurt, or would have already been hurt. But what we don't do is beat our chest and say things here are good, actually.
Yeah.
We don't say, find me in the streets, you know? And like what David Cage and his partner at Quantic Dream did when that first story broke was literally say, we will defend our honor, right?
Their internal analysis was to suggest like this was outliers. Like let's say like the most like the best case possible scenario for like why they feel aggrieved is like, well, these were outliers that, you know, bad things happen at all different levels of employment at different companies, and this is not representative of like our workplace. Well, like you can still have the humility to say like, well, this still happened. Like right. No matter how great of a workplace you run, like things are going to occur, and like what you are supposed to do is like show some humility over that and say, I don't feel this represents the Quantic Dream that I go to every day, but like if this happened and these people were aggrieved and they feel insulted or oppressed and like unhappy at their jobs, like one incident is, you know, one time. I mean, I don't mean to write the press statement for him, but like that's like hopefully right, that's
one,
the
one incident.
Hopefully that's
of
the
this
humility
type.
that the way we like, you know, try to talk the talk and walk the walk is like, you know, is to think of in those terms is like what happens when it comes to your house. Like you need right. to you need to be ready for that. You need to be able to be thinking of that. And it just seems like that was it struck me as like if that was his response, like. Is that how he responds to actual internal grievances too? Is, you know, buck up? And I don't know. Like I haven't done the reporting. I can't speak to that, but I do know that you know, it is far more common for people in power to use the threat of the legal journey to try and stop voices from speaking up than it is to try and make things right.
It is a lot. It is, you know, it is also, we're not that far removed from Sony's statement about allegations at Naughty Dog, basically being to bury it on a Saturday and say like, well, we don't have it written down anywhere, so it didn't happen. It has not been a good year for these, responses. Because the response should be to take those claims seriously, to investigate them internally, to take measures to correct, and to like, be thoughtful about the people you work with and like how to make their, if you're running a place, you know, I this is the thing I've ever thought of before until it turned out that I came here to build this with y'all. but like there is a responsibility if you're running a place to your workers who are like pushing themselves really hard. Like game development is a really difficult job. We just ran that story about the so-called joke by the Warhammer 40K Inquisitor devs about or the PR, whoever made that statement that was like, you know, well, sadly, we have to delay this game, but guess what? Now our devs are going to get back to work 90 hours a week until this game is finished. Like, we live in a place where crunch is normalized, where that, like, even that is... that work culture is acceptable, is already too far. You know, forget about the photoshopping, you know, people onto nudes and onto Nazi pictures. Like, that stuff that was happening or reportedly happening at Quantic Dream is also fucking terrible. But, like, even that base level, even without that stuff, the sort of, like, crunch culture is already bad enough. And as a manager, you have a responsibility to ensure that the people who are busting their asses and, one, are not being overworked to death, and, two, like, are living in a, or working in a place, hopefully not living there at all. Hopefully living at home with their families or in their apartments or whatever, but are working in sustainable and healthy and safe and comfortable positions. And that has to be a priority for you, and it needs to be something that you can put time and resources into. Like, so much of this comes down to prioritization. You know, in response to this stuff, Cage said, and this is in the Kotaku piece, that, like, it's like we didn't know about that. If, you know, obviously I'm just like, I'm not going to go and check this guy's computer, basically. Here it is. If we had been aware of these images, if we had seen them, we would have stepped in. But he creates them on his computer on his free time. I'm not going to dig into the personal computers of my employees. And one, like, that does not line up with the facts of the reported cases, which have them, you know, being spread around the company, which have, you know, similar distasteful images being in public in the company. But two, like, that response is so defensive, right? That response isn't, Quantic Dream is supposed to be a safe place. I take great umbrage to this. I want to make sure that this space is you know, one where people can work productively, where they can focus on doing their work as artists and creators, and anything like this in the future has to be dealt with swiftly. Like, it's not, there's no commitment to that here. All it is hand washing, and it's just so despicable. It's so frustrating because Cage is someone who again and again positions himself as a savior for the medium, and for whatever reason keeps getting a stage to do that. And it is so frustrating to be in video games where that story breaks today and you can see people who are like, yeah, well, fuck the journalists because they're journalists. It sucks. the answer is to just keep reporting, right? The answer is to continue reporting, to continue doing good critical work, and to, like, kind of, you know, stick by your guns on this stuff.
Yes, true. That's easy to say. That's easy.
We ain't being sued,
because you know what? Here's like a very likely outcome from this, is that these lawsuits were filed. There's going to be money spent on both sides to. I don't know much about the French legal system, so right. I'm going to only speak from my experience watching some of these suits, having lived through some of the stuff, working at Gawker when all that was crumbling. And is that, like, not hard to imagine that this, like, goes through the initial phases and then is just dismissed outright. But is the legacy of it is a reporter who gets, you know, a message from a Quantic Dream employee says, well, actually, I don't have time for this. Actually, I don't want to investigate this. Because you know what? That is 100% what is going to happen. It is going to make any reasonable journalist think twice about priorities, about, like, is this worth dragging my company into a legal fight? Like, how bad is this infringement? Like, whatever happened to this person, like, how bad is it? Because they've already shown that they're willing to take this to court. Because my own experience with, like, multiple legal teams and multiple companies, like if I was to take some of that stuff to them, their response would be like, is this really worth it? Is this really the fight that you need our company to go through?
Like, I want
to
say,
and,
like,
it's... Go ahead.
Briefly speaks to something... Again, we're not from these French outlets, but all three of us have dealt with legal teams in our time as reporters, as journalists, as critics, in which all of those, you know, circumstances, we have to run something by someone in legal and say, hey, you know, here's, we ran that Sleeping Dog story, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about something we actually ran and not something that we had to kill. We ran the Sleeping Dogs story, which is a story in which we looked at what a sequel to Sleeping Dogs would look like based on some data that we received, that we verified, that we had multiple sources say was accurate. And there's a lot of ways that story could have looked. There's versions of it where it's just a huge data dump where, like, people's names are available, where there's like, oh, yeah, here's when this person came into the office, right? We didn't do that one, right? We weren't going to do that one. The one where we're just like, fuck it, here it all is not on the table. But there's probably a version of it that's maybe a little more open and is like, you know, here's 30 pages versus what we ended up doing, which was like, here are selections. And we did that because we worked very closely with Vice's legal department on figuring out what we could safely publish to make sure that our sources were protected, which is a responsibility for us, and also for what was verifiable and necessary to tell the story we wanted to tell. I cannot imagine the hoops that needed to be jumped through from these three outlets to publish the stories that they published about Quantic Dream.
Yeah.
Again, maybe all three of those outlets had really lax lawyers, legal teams. Yeah, but no. The fact that this is part of why it's so important to me to say this was from three places. Even though they were reporting kind of together, even though they kind of shared notes and contacts and all that stuff is all absolutely true. So I don't want to say it's three completely independent stories or something, right? But they each had to be run through three editorial boards, three different legal teams. And at any point, one of those people could have been like, yo, no, there's not enough here to verify this. Hey, you know, you don't have enough source, you know, secondary source reporting that confirms the kind of story that was put forward here. There's all sorts of ways for stories like this to fall apart. Trust me. but what you have to, like, so for me, like, I just want to make sure that it's clear to people listening, because sometimes you think of, like, a reported story as being the only people involved are the reporter and then anybody whose specific name comes up in a story, when in fact there's lots of interviews on background, when there's lots of interviews for people who used to be at the company and now can't be, when there's lots of, interviews where you say, like, hey, can you confirm XYZ? I won't put your name in the thing, but on background, you're giving me the confirmation so that I can then go forward and find another source who will put their name on it. Or I can say, hey, I've heard from such and such a person, or not even from such and such a person, I've heard from someone who knows that XYZ happened, can you confirm for my story? Those sorts of things happen all the time and don't make it into the 1500 word story or 3000 word story or 500 word story. And so, like, it's a thing we've talked about before, that there is a serious risk in the current moment for journalists when people with big, bank accounts can come for them and be like, yo, we're going to shut this down. No idea how this case is going to shake out. I hope that the journalists are well protected. I hope that their organizations protect them and as individuals. We'll see.
It should be noted as well that this is a major thing and sort of obviously global democracy right now in terms
right.
of freedom of
exactly.
press. But it's... God damn. So it's incredibly important in our industry, and it's incredibly important in the wider world as well. So this is one of those issues where it's like, yeah, this one has a lot of tentacles, I suppose you could say.
Right. I mean, that's the thing that's so weird, right? Is like, so we had a question in to briefly dip into the question bucket because this went a little longer. We had one come in from Chris from Philly who says, as someone slowly growing more entrenched in academia, I'm trying to trace some links between literary theory and game narratives. One of the most frustrating things about it is how closed off we are from anything that feels like it could reach a wider group of people. And as someone who grew up in a fairly privileged place where a lot of people weren't, my hometown was on the edge of West Philadelphia and has a lot of first-generation immigrants and people of color and a huge range of wealth between its more suburban and urban sides, I want to find a way to both continue doing the work I love doing and have it have some kind of positive impact on the people like those I grew up with. Y'all seem to have had such a range of experiences getting to this point. I was wondering if that's ever a question you've grappled with yourselves, and how you feel you have or haven't answered it. In other words, how does the work we do now, as games journalists, like, affect the world and help people, reach the people we grew up with, reach the audiences that we know are underserved, etc. And it's funny because, as Danielle just said, like, the big picture view, games journalism is such a tiny little corner of the world. When you have something like Sinclair Media, the stuff that's been happening with them in the news lately around pressuring their journalists to kind of do spin for, like, kind of a right-wing ideology at their local news stations, not just like, this isn't just like a Fox News thing, right? Like, yeah. Sinclair owns a bunch of local news affiliates, and had people read this like really absurd thing about fake news. And then like in general has also had some cases where journalists and news anchors have come forward and said like, yeah, there's a bunch of shit we're not comfortable with. And you know, it's funny to be like, oh, but also swords of ditto, battle tech. you know, there is a responsibility to talk about this stuff in this space because weirdly, I think we almost have an opportunity to talk about it. Because we're reaching people who maybe aren't going to go listen to Citations Needed, you know?
Right.
They're not going to go dig into the Deadspin article about Sinclair or about, you know, they're not going to go read Media Matters or, you know what I mean? Like, they're not going to dig into that side of this thing. And also, weirdly, we've confronted this stuff before in a weird way here or there. Not the specific games journalists being sued, but we've seen what the larger social kind of problems can look like in the microscopic community of games, you know, in just our little kind of diorama. We've seen how small trends elsewhere can kind of like impact a whole community all at once, whether that's through something like Gamergate, or even, I guess, like, you know, Patrick, you know, it wasn't Kotaku being sued by Hulk Hogan, right? But like, Gawker is like a society blog, or had been kind of a society and news blog, that was hit by this in a similar way, and Kotaku was almost caught up by that. Mm-hmm. I think that there is a responsibility to at least talk about this stuff. And I, you know, we've talked before when these stories first broke, like, what is our responsibility to this game and covering it in ways in which, you know, to our audience about this game and the ways in which we should cover it and whether or not we should confront this stuff or give it airtime or what. Like, and I'm still working through some of that. You know, I have some great pitches from writers I love about how to tackle Detroit. And we've got to figure out which of those writers we support and what stuff we do internally, and what sort of coverage we want to give it all together. Like, I'm not quite sure where I am on that stuff yet, and today's response definitely gives me some more thinking to do, you know?
Yeah, because, I mean, it's one of those things where it's not as easy. I mean, I think people with purposely not the best of intentions, like, looked at something like how we handled Kingdom Come Deliverance and said,
right,
well, they're just going to, you know, any game that, you know, runs aside of their politics, like, that's just the treatment. It's like, you know, like, that was a very deliberate choice for, like, a very specific reason. And it's actually, like, you know, look at, you know, Dawson, your review of, like, Far Cry 5, or, like, you know, certain things in my, like, God of War review. Like, actually, like, there's usefulness in, like, using, like, moments like that to, like, discuss those issues in, like, that. The scope of coverage, and like, maybe, you know, where we'll land on Detroit Become Human is like, actually let's think about all this shit, and then what do we have to say about what this game is and what it says and what it tries to do and where that fits in like a larger context of like Quantic Dream and video game. Like, that's very much still like a viable path. It's just a matter of like where we fall and often how we even just respond to the game, right? Like, part of Kingdom Come was like, I don't know, like, didn't respond very strongly to the game. Right. And it's like, do we really want to walk this hill because of everything else? And it was like, no.
I agree with all of the above. This is also why I volunteer, and need to feel like I do things in my community, like my local community, as well as the sort of bigger community, that I live in sort of online. So that's, I would lose my mind, I think, if I didn't do sort of like a physical thing as well as sort of like the mental and intellectual things that I do. So that's, if the writer finds that helpful at all, I sure do.
Yeah, definitely local involvement feels like not the cure to this per se. And also maybe not the only technique. Like, it's definitely one of those things where, like, I definitely have met people who are like, oh, yeah, like, I'm an activist. And what they mean is, like, I tweet a bunch.
Yeah, no.
And that can be really frustrating. Not that online, you know, work isn't valuable, but, like, that there is...
It's a lot of what we do.
It's a lot of what we do. But, like, and I've made peace with that, which is why I don't call myself an activist, right? Like, I absolutely think that I can help inform people and can help bring people together and can help people engage with critical ideas. But when I see the work that activists do on the ground or that volunteers do on the ground, or that charity workers, or that, you know, lots of people can go make someone's, you know, people who are actually part of neighborhood programs, combat violence, or to ensure combat poverty or hunger. Like, there is such a big difference between that and me retweeting some good shit, you know, that I think that if you are doing something in the academic space or in the kind of pop cultural criticism space, or there is a way in which you should be thinking about how to be involved locally, whether that's just in your PTA or in local town council meetings, or doing the other thing, right? Which is like, it sounds like, Chris from Philly, you are pretty committed to the idea of producing work that at the very least reaches that audience and isn't just reaching the kind of ivory tower or academia audience, which is hard to do because as someone who comes from academia, there is a lot of resistance, or there has been historically a lot of resistance, of work that does that sort of crossover. Publishing, the academic publishing space is very buttoned up until you are like a tenured and, you know, a tenured professor who's already published a bunch, at which point then you get to experiment, but also then you're like 15 years too late to do anything that's like truly experimental. It's a weird space. So what I'll say is, like, commit to that. Try to find places locally that you can contribute or that you can help, and try to find issues where there is room for that crossover and where your expertise in academia can provide some additional help. Like, it sounds like what you're doing is lit theory and game narratives. Think about going to like a program for kids, right? And like running some sort of weekend story times, or like something that's about getting kids involved with media criticism, whether that's like playing video games and talking about them. Like, what was Sam, who used to be on Match 3, did something like this, mm-hmm. right, Patrick?
Yeah. He worked, he, you know, like worked with kids, was an educator, but also like helped run like game spaces for kids that, you know, gave them a cool place to interact with games after school, and right. A lot of games that they didn't know existed because, like, he was someone that like was well versed in that world, and could help expose those kids to interesting things that they might not come across otherwise. Right. And like right. That was his one way of like, you know, trying to give back, or to have something that felt like a practical effect, even if you don't necessarily see like where that leads. It's just like, you know, being able to put something out there and connect with people, was very meaningful to him. And that sounds like something that this reader can do too.
Totally. For people who don't know Match 3, people should go listen to Match 3. It was a very good podcast.
Yeah,
still available, right?
So, yeah, yes, sort of. Yes and no. So yes, if you go to archive.is, I think that's I put up an archived version.
Gotcha.
Of it, which I didn't realize they would just like host like dead podcasts. There's probably like bandwidth limits and to stuff like that, but yeah, like all of Match 3 is archived up there. But then I have to repopulate the feed, which I did like the first episode, and I just haven't gotten around to the rest. But it's also, it's going to freak a bunch of people out because they'll just think there's like a bunch of new episodes.
70 new episodes.
Not true. But yeah, it is all up there. Yeah, like a lot of what Sam spoke to on that podcast that I did also with Kotaku writer Gita Jackson was, a lot of like through the lens of education and like just observing. Like, it would have been awesome to have heard from Sam when all the Fortnite stuff was happening, because he is basically on the ground level is all that was taking off. So
totally.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about our waypoints. Also, briefly, as always, if you have an email, you can send it over to gaming@vice.com. Use the subject questions. We got a bunch of really great ones in, but obviously we spent the time elsewhere today. We'll loop back around for some of those next time. Let's talk about our waypoints for the week. Patrick, you said you have a second one. What is your second one?
Sure. Over the last couple of days, I watched Insidious, The Last Key, the fourth in the Insidious franchise, which I actually I quite like those movies. They have a really good style, and the first movie especially is really scary and well done. The fourth one's not up particularly good, but I was disappointed largely because of the director they had chosen was this really talented indie filmmaker who I would recommend not watching Insidious: The Last Key, and instead watching the movie that got him picked up and on the radar of horror director James Wan, who's off doing Aquaman and Fast and the Furious now. The movie he did before was called The Taking of Deborah Logan, which posits itself as a movie about a potential exorcism, but like the way it also deals with like aging and what it means to get old and to lose parts of your mental faculties, and twist that up in a really interesting, like really thoughtful. I don't want to say too much about the plot, but like there's a lot of like playing around with those ideas, and you can see why he was picked up to do a bigger movie. And I think that movie is a much better showcasing of his talents.
Nice.
Awesome.
I think it's on Netflix. It was on Netflix for a while. I don't know if it's still there.
Danielle, what about you? What is your waypoint for the week?
All right, well, I'm not going to necessarily recommend that other people do this, but I had a very interesting experience with some 60s board games that were made for young girls.
Oh, boy.
So I played Mystery Date, the original 1965 Mystery Date this weekend, as well as a game called What Shall I Wear, which is like a Milton Bradley game, I think, maybe.
Well, wait, what did you... We just go over these a little bit. I want details.
Mystery Date. You might be familiar with Mystery Date, because it had like a 90s reboot that was like slightly modernized. But like, basically, the entire mechanics of the game are collecting the right outfit, like three pieces of the right outfit for a cool date with a hot boy. And and then you land, you know, you're sort of, you have a little piece on a board and you have cards that are, you know, where you collect the pieces of outfits. And then if you land on a open the door square, you open this door in the middle of the game board and there's a mystery boy. He's either the skiing boy or the bowling boy or the formal boy. I think there's one other boy.
Or the dud. Famously done in The Simpsons, right?
Yeah, or the dud, Homer, by the way.
Shouting, you got the dud.
The dud is definitely like the cutest one, so I don't know what the hell.
I think that's just a time thing, probably, right? Like a that's like, you know, it's nerd chic. I'm sure that whoever that kid is now
he's in Bushwick. That's all. That's all that's happening. He's just a dude in Bushwick.
Perfect.
But like, both this and also What Shall I Wear, very similar mechanics, What Shall I Wear, but What Shall I Wear is like slightly less sexist, because the entire point of it is also to sort of collect outfits, but it's to do activities, not necessarily like land a man. Like there's okay. activities that are like going fishing or going swimming or going on a road race, and there's also like girls of color in that one. Wow. So it was actually like that's way better. Yeah, this was 1969, and the Mystery Date is 1965. So, like, What Shall I Wear? Definitely still obsessed with clothing and, like, wearing the right clothes for an occasion, but at least you get, like, options. And one of them is, like, going to a college, like, open house, I guess. So it's like, oh, cool. All right, that's way better than just, you're going to die alone if you don't have the right outfit for Bobby, you know? So...
Perfect.
Very interesting games to play as sort of like an exercise in, oh wow, this sure is some fucking propaganda, normie ass propaganda from the 60s. But this was like what was marketed to girls in the 60s. Mm-hmm. So fascinating, terrifying experience.
God, that is, I really love playing games from other eras like that, which is not a thing we really get to do that often because... video games are I guess what I'd say is that like the theming of board games is so not complete, but like, you know, you could have a game about dating from the 1960s in the board game space. And that doesn't say that there weren't old dating sims in the 1980s or games about romance or something like that. But in video games and computer games, things are like so much more focused on shooting aliens and driving cars fast, especially in the arcade scene, and like lots of like what our nostalgia retro gaming vibes are not that focused, you know, or not that focused, or don't go that far back, you know. So it's nice to be able to be like, okay, well, let's look at this cultural artifact. We have a really great piece on the site from Robert Rath, who looked at the history of the game of Life, right?
Yeah.
And some other similar
games.
The
Mansion of Happiness. It started out as a religious propaganda game called The Mansion of Happiness, and it was about how to get to heaven and live a good life, basically. So yeah,
and that eventually became The Game of Life.
Yeah.
And like it's worth looking at that stuff. I love looking at like the history of games like Monopoly, and just board games and tabletop games and war games in general have had such a florid and strange history that one day video games will get there. In 50 years, people will be looking back and be like, ah, David Cage, right? that fucker. And until then, it's up to us to do that. My waypoint for the week is, unsurprisingly,
watch Detroit Book of Human is going to be really, really good.
Oh, God, man.
It could be, right? Like, that's the thing. Like, who the
fuck? I hope it is, too.
I have doubts, but who the fuck knows? It could be really good. It could be like, we could all go play it and be like, man, fuck. Like, here we are. It's super
best
good.
Best surprise of the that year.
That would make for, like, a really fascinating, like, yeah, review, too.
Totally.
It's like, totally. How do you sort of, like, with these two things in one hand?
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
Totally. We'll see. We'll see how it all shakes out.
Plus, I like good games.
I do like good games a lot. One of them is a game called Battletech that comes out this week. I'm not going to get too deep into it here. Like I said, I'm going to talk about it with Rob at some point this week on a podcast. It's a fascinating game because there is... It's one of those games that's going to be hard for me to actually recommend to a wide audience. Patrick, you asked me in chat after we streamed a little bit of it.
Oh, is this where you're gonna break it to me?
Maybe. So you basically were like, hey, is that a game that I
like
could
XCOM,
play?
I like Fire Emblem. I like Into the Breach, but like I'm unwilling and not interested to go into like the deep end. Is basically where
so
I
this
see strategy
isn't,
games.
I would say that this is not the deep end, but it doesn't do the best job of telling you that it's not the deep end. It's a game that, like, I think has a lot of really fan. So Battletech is a game that takes place in the Battletech universe, a.k.a. the MechWarrior universe, if you played any of the MechWarrior kind of action mech games. MechWarrior is actually a really interesting comparison here, because, like, MechWarrior is a game that on its face is like, ugh, there's, like, heat management, and there's, like, all these subsystems, and, like, how do I know which weapons to shoot, and there's ranges to manage, and there is a lot, there's more, right? But it isn't a flight sim. Do you know what I mean? You're not ever in MechWarrior. In the MechWarrior games, you're never, like, going through a hyper-complicated startup sequence where you need to, like, mouse look around your cockpit and flip the right switches the way if you were playing, like, Falcon whatever or Jane's whatever, any, like, the true, like, flight simulators.
I played a lot of MechWarrior 2
right.
on my PC.
I feel like this game is very similar to that. I mean, like, obviously it's the same mechs, it's the same universe. I think it's set before MechWarrior 2 in the big universe. But you're dealing with the same sorts of things. So you are dealing with things like heat management. But what that really means is there's a bar that fills up, and if it gets too hot, if it goes too far, if you fire too many, like, laser weapons, you know, in a row, you're going to overheat and cause some damage to your internals. Yes, there are, you know, lots of icons on the screen and lots of weird sub-rules, but I don't know that it is any more complicated than, like, mid to late game XCOM. I think it starts at a higher level of like, and I don't think it does a great job of introducing you to some of its core mechanics. There's a really good guide that's on the forums that's written by someone who works at Harebrained Schemes. So it was developed by Harebrained Schemes, who made the Shadowrun games recently.
I played that first one, and it was really good, and I heard the second one.
The second two are, like, so much better than the first one. Huh. Like, both of those games are high contenders for a future Waypoint 101, because I think they're, like, genuinely really cool RPGs. And so it's more complex than those games, and less story-heavy than those games. There's still lots of story, really gorgeous cutscenes, actually. Like, really phenomenal cutscenes, great soundtrack. But, like, less, like, I am this one character who is... I mean, you are a character, but it's not like I'm a character in this world. It's, like, you're a character who ends up running a mercenary company. And you have, like, your crew. It's like, again, really cool crew, really diverse characters. Like, outside of the mech warriors who you hire, there are no white people on that ship. And, like, it's your character, if your character is white. But there's, like... And the universe is so fascinating because it is our universe, but, like, 1,500 years in the future. So, like, you know, your ship engineer is like, wears a hijab and is Muslim, and, like, talks about her grandfather who runs a taxi service to Dar es Salaam, which is, like, each of the factions has enough of an Islamic population. They each have their own holy sites. And so this is the Dar es Salaam of this one sub-faction. And this other guy, you know, he grew up, you know, kind of in a blue-collar family, and his dad... You know, worked on the like space docks his whole life, and now he's like, I'm getting to go out there and live the dream. My dad was stuck on the docks. I'm on the ship, and it's like really fascinating character work inside of that. And then you go into the tactical combat, and it is complex because it's different. Because, like, you expect XCOM, which means you expect, like, oh, there will be little cover icons, and there aren't cover icons, right? You can be in cover by being in the forest, and that reduces the damage you take, but that is not the same thing, because it shouldn't be, because big walking mechs are not people, you know? There is a difference between being in a huge mech, and I guess the one thing that I'll say is super fascinating to me is – that there was a different sense of time scale in this game, and it's something I'm really excited to talk to Rob about, when it comes to successes and failures, that you can win, you know, you win a fight in XCOM, and let's say that, like, you got maybe a couple people hurt, but you didn't get anybody killed. You know, you run the clock for a little bit, and those people get healed up, and they're going to be fine. There are some fights that I walk away from in Battletech, where they goddamn well may as well have been losses, because you have a bank account in this game because you're running a company. You're running a mech warrior company. You're running a mercenary company. And it costs money to fix up your shit. And it costs parts. And, like, you got to make sure that, like, you know, you are spending the time to repair the right mechs before you go out to combat. And all that isn't actually all that complicated when it comes to the mechanics of it. But what ends up happening is, like, you win a fight, you get your paycheck, you, like, get to salvage stuff from the mechs that you've destroyed. Like, maybe you got a headshot, so there's actually a lot of salvage available. And maybe you negotiated a special deal where you get more salvage and less money, so it's super exciting. And then you look at the cost it's gonna take to repair all your shit, and you're like, God damn, how are we gonna make ends meet? Like, I don't know how to make it another month or two. There's a little clock that's ticking down that's basically like, this is how many months you have left before you go broke. And that's kind of the equivalent of all of the countries pulling out of the XCOM agreement or whatever. It's like, do you go broke or not? And so you end up, like, chasing these little small missions, and every once in a while a big one comes in, and you can kind of stay afloat off of that money for a little bit longer. It actually has that weird kind of the story of something like a Firefly or a Cowboy Bebop of just like, how am I going to fucking make ends meet? And it does that really well. So it's like, if you can get over that initial hump of not being too stressed about heat management and, like, positioning and all of that, and just kind of play the game and let yourself just advance. And also, there's a really decent save system where it's just constantly doing background saves and telling you where they are, and you can kind of, like, jump back. I've jumped back to the start of a battle a bunch of times because I've, like, lost a pilot or something. You'll be okay, but I'm a little cautious about recommending it to you, Patrick, because I can see you bouncing off of it and being like, "Oh, fuck this game." But
yeah, sounds like I might be more so just spending more, going back to Into the Breach and just
playing some more Into the Breach. It's such a different game. It's like the opposite of what I love about Into the Breach, which is its simplicity. And it's like, I mean, this game still has some choreography to it. This game still has, like, those moments where, like, it does scale really well. Little mechs are really tiny. Big mechs are really big. And so, like, having a 20-foot-tall or 20-ton mech being chased around by a 55-ton mech, you're just like, oh, shit, I got to get out of this forest. This sucks. And Into the Breach doesn't really do scale in that way. And so it delivers in, like, a different sort of mech fantasy. But it's something we'll be talking about more with Rob, and I'll try to do a couple more streams of it for sure. Maybe more than a couple more. We'll see how they go. That is my waypoint. I had to talk about mechs. I'm Austin Walker, goddamn. So, all right, that is going to do it for us this week. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that, waypoint.zone/BOEN. Shout-outs also to – who else do I shout out? I'm shouting out – shout-outs to, you know, everybody on the team. Shout-outs to Danica. Shout-outs to Rob. Shout-outs to Joel. Shout-outs to Natalie. Just
shout outs to Matt Pasquale and his 16 kills in PUBG.
Yo, oh, that was unbelievable. Oh. Please go watch. Danica just made a video comparing your crossbow situation to Matt Pasquale's John Wicking of that entire game. Go watch that over at twitter.com/waypoint. As always, you can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/waypointvice, youtube.com/waypointvice, twitch.tv/waypoint, and you know, as always, waypoint.vice.com. All right, until I eventually trick Rob into getting onto a microphone to talk about mechs with me for at least an hour.
Good.
That's going to do it for us. Danielle, what do we say to him?
Be good and be good at it.
Peace. Take that advice, David Cage.